Well, last year we had an introduction to the intertestamental period, and we got a certain amount in our outline, and we're going to be picking up where, pretty much where we left off, but because it was a year ago, and we've also had have some folks here who weren't in the class last year, I thought we would spend probably today reviewing, and for those of us who were in the class, it will help us to remember where we were. And for those who weren't, can get a kind of a whirlwind tour of what we covered previously. So we're talking about the time between the testaments. You know, the book of Malachi ends the Old Testament, and Matthew is the first book of the New Testament. And so we're talking about what happened in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And some of you know that this is often referred to as the 400 silent years. Silent is used because there was no recorded revelation from God during that period. So we had revelation up through the Old Testament, and then we have a new set of revelation happening at the opening of the New Testament era. And so that time is often called the silent years because God was silent and not revealing himself in special revelation during that period. So we went over some reasons for studying the period. I have this section titled, Why Study This Period? So why study this period? I might turn that around and ask a different question. Why is this period neglected, and why do we know so little about this period? The reason I started studying this period personally was because I realized I don't know what happened in between the Testaments. And I really had a black hole there, and I sensed that there were a lot of things that happened that were really relevant for the New Testament in order to be able to read the New Testament well. And so I just kind of started studying, and that's kind of where this class grew out of. But why is this period neglected, and why do we know so little? Well, the obvious reason is because it's not recorded in the Bible, and we follow the Bible very carefully, but the Bible doesn't record anything about this period, so that's the main reason naturally. But then I was thinking, but we study church history. Church history is in an era, you know, after the Bible stopped, and we study that. Now, I could turn that around and say, well, we're all ignorant of church history too, which by and large we are, and we need to study church history more. But we do study church history period. So this is kind of analogous to that. It's a time where things were going on. It's not recorded in the scriptures. So that's one of the reasons that I think we have sort of a black hole in our knowledge during this period. But we talked about more than this in the original class, but I just highlighted two things here on why we study this, why it's important to study the period. The first of those is that there were very important literary developments that happened during this period. Most of you have heard of the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. That happened during this period. Most of you have also heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Dead Sea Scrolls were by and large written during this period, which tell us a lot about what was going on in Judaism, both culturally and more importantly religiously, during this period. And so that's another important literary body of literature that came about during this period. And then we have a whole set of books that are sometimes collected in collections and sometimes are even in printings of the Bible. One of those is the Apocrypha. So the Apocrypha has had a significant influence on the Roman Catholic Church and some other traditions that use the Apocrypha. And that body of literature, along with a whole bunch of other books that we'll talk about briefly in a few minutes, they were all written, and that body of literature developed during this period. So that's the first reason I wanted to highlight here in review, literary developments. The second reason is, which I already mentioned, it provides us context for understanding the New Testament. For instance, at the close of the Old Testament, I was talking to my kids about this the other day. It was interesting to get their kind of, you're always trying to see, like, what exactly do you know? Are you understanding what you're reading in the Bible? But when the Old Testament closes, who's in charge? Like, what's going on in the world at the close of the Old Testament? Real question. Who can answer that? Like, who's the world power? It's a real quiz. You're just like my kids. They couldn't answer either. Well, we remember we had the Babylonian Empire, and then at the close of the Old Testament, we have the Persian Empire is in control. Now, what do we find when we open the pages of the New Testament? Who's in charge? The Roman Empire is in charge. So, you know, big difference in who's running the world at that point in time politically. There's a big difference there. How did that transition happen? How did that transition affect the context of Jesus' ministry when he comes on the scene? The other thing is, think of all the features that we find in the New Testament, and most of this is lost on us. Because we've been reading the New Testament for so long, we don't even think about it. Think about all the features in the New Testament in Jesus' day that are not found in the Old Testament. Think about that for a second. Can you name off a few features or things in the New Testament that aren't in the Old Testament? Real question again. You can feel free to put your neck out there and try to answer. John. Right, the Jewish groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, not in the Old Testament. Did you know that? What are some other things? Give me one more. Things that are found in the New Testament that are not in the Old Testament. The Jewish groups is one good answer, yeah. Baptism, yeah. Right, there is a history there of sprinkling and things like that that's related to that. But yeah, that's true. Pastor, were you going to say something? The synagogue. It's another really good example. I think he did have that answer. Yeah, the synagogue. So just, you know, we've got the synagogue, we've got the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, all of those groups, the Herodians, the Sanhedrin is very, you know, prominent in the New Testament. So there's a lot of things like that that we read just by second nature because we've read the New Testament and we don't give it another thought. But all of those things, my point is that all of those things developed during the silent years. And if you don't study something other than the Bible, you would never even know where those things came from and how they came about. And remember, that's important for us because that was the context that Jesus was ministering in and that the New Testament, the apostles were ministering in. That was second nature to them. Think about Paul. What was the first thing that Paul did when he went into a new town in Europe now, in Asia Minor? What was the first thing he did? He went to the synagogue, right? What's a synagogue? We could ask that question. So it's very important developments that impacted the life of the New Testament, New Covenant believers in that era. And then, of course, we've got the other contextual thing for the New Testament is the political history and the religious situation. It tells us about the political history and the religious situation when John the Baptist and Jesus came on the scene. These were very tumultuous times in between the Testaments. And that's, by the way, another reason why we might shy away from it is it's so complicated. And, you know, you just read the book of Daniel, which contains prophecies about things that are happening in this period. And you think about all this political intrigue and this king with a bold face is lying to this other king and they're swapping daughters and marrying them off. This is all, I'm just paraphrasing the book of Daniel here. But you read that and it's like, who could figure this out? And it really is like that in the intertestamental period. There's all kinds of complicated stuff going on. But that political history and all the religious machinations that were happening is really the context where the New Testament comes into being. So it's nice for us to understand that. What were some of the characteristics of this period? Again, we covered this in more detail in the class, but I just mentioned major political upheavals, military conquests. It's a period in the area of Palestine, pretty much constant wars going on. Just constant wars for that whole period. Massive cultural changes for the Jew in that day, massive cultural changes and challenges. Religious struggles. Developments within Judaism. I was thinking about that this week. There's probably more significant changes in Judaism that happened during this period than almost any other period. There may be other things that you could point to with that, but think about it. Judaism from the time, let's just say from the time of Moses up to the time of the exile and even the return from the exile, it was pretty stable. The religious situation was pretty stable. There weren't a lot of changes in ideologies or anything like that. Even though there were repeated judgment and wars going on, there was still a sort of a focus and a center of we worship at the temple, we worship the one true God, Yahweh, etc. And even after the return from exile. But all of that changed during this period. Huge changes in the outlook of Judaism. And then that sets us up, by the way, for the New Testament and some of the kind of stuff that doesn't make sense to us when we read the New Testament. Why were the Pharisees so hostile to Jesus? Why were the Pharisees fighting with the Sadducees? All of that stuff has roots in this period, and we'll bring some of that out as we go along. And then the final thing about the characteristics of this period are the significant rise in the messianic hope, messianic expectations. A lot of eschatological themes are coming in. That means looking to the end times, looking for a deliverance at the end of the age. Apocalyptic writings. Do you know what apocalyptic writings are? Things like parts of the book of Daniel, Revelation is a type of apocalyptic literature. But sort of this looking forward to, there's a big change coming here where God is going to come and intervene in history and judge wickedness, and there's going to be righteousness restored and a new ruler, a messianic king. There's a pretty significant shift in thinking directly related to what God was doing with his people and with the world history really at this period in time. And so that's kind of the characteristics of what was happening in this period. And then by way of outline, that brings us to the outline for the class. And we've already been through some of this, and we'll review some of this today. I've restructured this a little bit since last time. So if you're working off of your old notes, there are some changes. By the way, if you do have your old notes still, I'm sure most of you don't, but if you do, some of the figures and stuff that were handed out, you might want to hold on to those. And the handouts, I'll try periodically to hand out some figures and things like that. Just hold on to those because we'll review them probably over and over again. And there's also some maps and things that we'll get into that I probably won't reproduce in color, but I'll try to email those out to you. If you want to print off a color copy, you can refer to. So I'll try to get those out to everyone ahead of time. But the outline of the course, so we looked at the Old Testament background for this period. We spent quite a bit of time there looking at what happened up to this period. Then we looked at the sources for the period. How do we know about this period? We looked at all the different sources. And then where we left off was we were right in the middle of the historical summary leading up to the Maccabean period. And that's where we're going to pick up the class in item number 3 there. We'll pick up in the middle of that. And we'll spend today, and we'll see how far we get today, but we'll do a whirlwind tour of those first 3 points today to get us up to that point. After that, we'll pause, we'll take a pause in the history part of it, and we'll look at some of the developments in Judaism that happened up to that point. And then we'll go back into history, and we'll go through the Maccabean and the Roman periods, and then that'll pretty much cover the history part of it. We'll take a look at the literature that developed during this period in some detail. And we'll look at the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha books and the Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that. We'll just have a brief summary of all that literature. And then sort of a summary of all the religious and cultural developments over the period. And then setting us up for the final section, which will be the New Testament context. How does all this bear on what we read in the New Testament? This is an ambitious project. There's a lot of material here. Hopefully your eyes won't be rolling back in your heads, but feel free to stop me and ask me questions too at any time. I'm probably raising all kinds of questions that I'm not aware of. It's because I'm sort of immersed in the topic here, but please feel free to raise your hand and stop me at any point, and then we'll go into the Old Testament background here. Yes. ESV has a lot of resources for this. I have the ESV Study Bible that has the, it comes with a key that you can get online and get a bunch of information. There used to be an ESV Study Bible in the library. There might still be one there. There's good articles on the, short articles on the intertestamental period that will summarize what we're talking about. There's also a lot of good maps and stuff, and you're pointing out that there's another set of resources. All right, so there's other resources out there. We'll try to share some of the names of the other resources as we get them. And I have a very extensive bibliography that I haven't printed because I don't think anybody wants it. But if you want any specific list of resources or something, I have all that. It's pretty daunting, but it's available if anybody wants it. If you want to read something, believe it or not, the most helpful thing for what we're going to cover in the next few weeks is probably Josephus. There are two Josephus volumes in the library available for checkout, and you can, I think you can get all of Josephus online for free now, just on the web. So if you want to tackle that, come and see me, and I'll give you the book, chapter, and sections to read. If you're interested in that, see me later. I'll try to dig that out for you. Any other questions before we kind of do our whirlwind review? Okay. So the first section was the Old Testament background. These are the events leading up to the intertestamental period. We covered this in a lot of detail, but we're just going to skim it here. In the first point there under A is the return from exile under the edict of the Persian ruler Cyrus. And this happened in 538 BC. I probably should say one other thing about the dating. Dating for this period is often off by, it's usually plus or minus 1 or 2 years. So if you see a date that's off by a year or two, that's common. Different people date things differently during this period. So just don't get too hung up about the exact dates. But 538 BC, we learn about this, of course, from the Bible. At the end of 2 Chronicles and the beginning of Ezra, if you remember, the decree to return. We also have this very interesting statement from the Cyrus Cylinder. We had a little study of the Cyrus Cylinder. We watched that little video, if you remember. The Armors aren't here today, but they were actually able to see it, visit it in Washington, D.C. when it was touring around last year. But the Cyrus Cylinder has this interesting statement. From Babylon, I sent back to their places, to the sanctuaries across the river Tigris, whose shrines had earlier become dilapidated, the gods who lived therein, and made permanent sanctuaries for them. I collected together all of their people and returned them to their settlements. So we have this interesting historical statement that corroborates what we read in 2 Chronicles and Ezra. So the Jews return back to the land, were really part of an overarching sort of philosophy of Cyrus, the Persian leader, of letting the captives go back to their places of origin throughout the empire, and actually having a very lenient policy on allowing them to worship their ancestral religions. And it's really part of a broader idea of Cyrus on how to build a strong empire. And so it's just interesting that that is going on from a world history standpoint, and the Jews are recipients of that, beneficiaries of that during this time. And of course, we know from Scripture that the Lord's hand is behind all of that, calling Cyrus his anointed. And then once the return happened, we have the rebuilding of the temple. The altar was rebuilt first. To remember, the foundations of the temple were laid in the second year of the return. We read that in Ezra chapter 3. And then you also remember from reading Ezra that there was a period of opposition to the rebuilding. That period of opposition lasted about 16 years, just to put it all in perspective. And then about 20 years after the return, the temple was completed by Zerubbabel and Yeshua. You remember that. We read about that again in Ezra, that Zerubbabel and Yeshua came back in the sixth year of Darius. That, again, in context, that's about 20 years later after the return. And they did that following the calls of two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, who prophesied about the same time and basically brought the message to rebuild the temple, complete the temple. You remember what Haggai says, things like, you're living in your houses and my house is a ruin. Rebuild the temple. And Zerubbabel and Joshua responded to that call and actually did complete the temple. The next thing that happened after that was the events in Esther. These occurred during the reign of Ahasuerus, as he's called in the Bible. He's also better known by his Greek name, Xerxes. And just remember that Esther dovetails in there between the rebuilding of the temple and then the final events in the Old Testament, which relate to Ezra and Nehemiah's ministry. So those are the final events. And Ezra's journey to Jerusalem, and we remember this happened in the seventh year. Actually, you can, if you look at the back of your outline, there's a sort of a chronological table here that we'll refer to later, but you can see the Persian rulers there on the left, and sort of in the event column there, you can kind of see what's happening there. And so you notice that more towards the top, you see Haggai and Zechariah's ministry and the temple being reconstructed. And then way down towards the bottom, you see Ezra traveling to Jerusalem. And so remember, we learn about all of that stuff from the book of Ezra. So when you read the first few chapters of Ezra, remember, that happened 70 years, 80 years before Ezra came on the scene. It's something that we often don't put together when we're reading it. There is some chronological difficulty some unraveling that has to happen in Ezra. But that's something that I often forget when I'm reading the first part of Ezra. I'm thinking, oh yeah, Ezra's writing this. But Ezra was actually on the scene 70 years later and is summarizing what happened. So Nehemiah, then, you remember, traveled to Jerusalem. This happened about 13 years after Ezra. And you can see on your outline there that that's a little bit further down there in the reign of Artaxerxes. And when he returned, I won't summarize everything that Nehemiah did there, but you remember he rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. Now, he was actually called back to Persia. Remember, he was a high official for the king. He was the cupbearer to the king. We read that as kind of a slave kind of job, but in actuality, it was a very high position in the kingdom and a trusted position. You remember when Nehemiah asked to return, one of the first questions the king asked was, when are you coming back? So he had an interest in Nehemiah coming back. Well, he did return in about the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes. That places him in Jerusalem about 12 years. So just to put that in context, he was in Jerusalem for about 12 years, and he went back to Persia. We learn later in Nehemiah chapter 13 that he came back again to Jerusalem. And you remember the state of affairs that he found there. We don't know exactly when he came back. We don't know how long it was. But when he came back, what did he find? He found kind of a mess in Jerusalem. You remember he had to cleanse the temple of outsiders that had encroached. You remember the story of him throwing the furniture of the one guy out of the temple area. He had to reestablish the tithes for the Levites that had been neglected since he had gone back to Persia. He had to reestablish the Sabbath. You remember the stories of people spying and selling on the Sabbath and him having to close the gates of Jerusalem so they couldn't come in. And then he had to correct the intermarriage violations again. The Jews had been intermarrying with the people around them, similar to what happened. You remember Ezra had it. There was a big emphasis in Ezra on that, purifying the marriage covenants. And Nehemiah had to deal with that again when he returned. So apparently it was a strong temptation to fall back into that. And then if you look on your outline, I've got way off to the right there the probable dates of Malachi. So Malachi is the final Old Testament writing, and Malachi was likely a contemporary with Ezra and Nehemiah. One of the reasons we believe that is you can note some of the similar themes that are in the book of Malachi. The corruption of the priesthood is dealt with, marriage to idolaters, abuse of the disadvantaged, and failure to tithe. Pretty much all the same things that Ezra and Nehemiah were dealing with at the time. And then we close the Old Testament, and I'm going to just turn briefly to Malachi, the very last book the very last words in the Old Testament. There's two things that we meet up with here at the end of the Old Testament, two key themes to remember that close the Old Testament revelation. The first of them is this idea of having two messengers, and this is in Malachi chapter 3. There's two messengers prophesied in Malachi. One of them is the messenger to prepare the way for the Lord, and the other one is the messenger of the covenant, coming in judgment to purify the sons of Levi, purifying the priesthood in righteousness. So that's one theme we find. And then the second theme, which is right at the very end of the book, we have this idea of a prophet who's going to come. And I'll read the last two verses of the Old Testament here. "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse." So we have this idea of a prophet that's going to come and sort of this threat of judgment also. That's a judgment is kind of wrapped up in that. Now, the interesting thing is these are the final words of the Old Testament. I was thinking about this the last few weeks. These are the final verses of the Old Testament. And then remember, that's when the silence started. And so these are the last things that would have been sort of ringing in the ears of God's people at this time. And then when we turn to the New Testament, what is the first revelatory event in the New Testament? Think about that. What's the first revelatory event in the New Testament? That's a good try. Think about a revelation from God that happened to an individual in the temple. I heard it. Zechariah. Think about that. That is actually the first revelatory event. We have the angel appearing to Mary and Joseph, but most likely the angel appearing to Zechariah happened first, because you remember John the Baptist was born earlier. So think about that. Now, what did the angel say to Zechariah? Does anybody hear any echo of anything in those words? Turn to Luke chapter 1. Let me just read it for you here. I'll quit torturing you with questions and just read it for you. Remember what we just read in Malachi. Listen to what the angel of the Lord says to Zechariah in the temple. "And he will go on," he, that is, his son, John the Baptist, "he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Now, what two things do you hear in what the angel said that would have been like a light going off in Zechariah's mind when he heard it? Hearts, right? Turning the hearts of the fathers to their children. And the other thing is in the spirit and power of Elijah. So I don't know if you ever connected the dots there. It's been very interesting for me to study this, how the last two verses of the Old Testament and the very first revelatory announcement in the New Testament is an echo of those words. And so Zechariah, certainly being one of the faithful and a priest, would have made that connection. So John is both the messenger to prepare the way for the Lord and the Elijah who is to come. And we're not going to look at this, but that is substantiated by Jesus in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 11, also Matthew chapter 17, Jesus actually explains that John the Baptist was the Elijah to come, and they've done to him as they wished, you remember. And then I forget which book it is, if it's Matthew or John, says, we understood later he was talking about John the Baptist. Okay? So the interesting point here, the only point I want to make, is the New Testament begins right where the Old Testament left off, some 400 years earlier. But the ending note on the Old Testament entering this period, other than that expectation of things to come, is really a situation of continued disobedience. That's where it leaves off. We've got Ezra and Nehemiah as the last historical thing we have going on. They're basically right in the middle of correcting abuses in the temple and in the town of Jerusalem. And then we see that there's a slide into serious disobedience with Nehemiah's absence, which was probably less than 10 years. He comes back after 10 years, and they've slid right back into the disobedience when he came on the scene originally. And then we have the final words of Malachi, which are basically rebuke and an expectation of judgment. And that's the context for the intertestamental period. That's how the Old Testament left off. And when we enter this period, that's the state of affairs in Jerusalem and with the people of the Lord. So that's a quick summary of the Old Testament background. Like I said, it's a whirlwind summary. Any questions or comments on that before we move to the next section? All right, so pretty clear. The next section is the sources. I'm turning back over to the outline here now. How do we know about the intertestamental period? It's not, for the most part, not in the Bible. How do we know about it? So we have the book of Daniel. This is the biblical reference that we have for the period. It's prophetic. The book of Daniel is writing in a prophetic way. And I mentioned this before in the class. It's so accurate that most liberal scholars, maybe all liberal scholars, believe that it was written after the events happened. That shows you how accurate the prophecies in the book of Daniel were. It's rare to even read anyone nowadays that thinks that Daniel was written back before these things happened. But anyways, so Daniel is a good source for us. The Apocrypha I mentioned, and we're going to cover this in detail much later, but we're really talking about the Old Testament Apocrypha here. These are the collection of 15 books that are sometimes printed in a Bible. These books were written in the period of about 200 BC to 100 AD. So some of it's kind of after this period, but a lot of it is during this period. Apocrypha is just a word that means hidden. Hidden things, or there's other debate about what that means, but just think of it as being the hidden things. And then we have another body of literature called the pseudepigrapha, and that's just a fancy word. You can see if you break it down, it means false inscription. And basically it's a series of literature that was written purportedly by famous people. So somebody would write this, and then they would attach a famous name to it so people would read it. False inscriptions, writings under the names of, for instance, in some cases, biblical characters. This is a collection of more than 60 titles and also written between the years of about 200 BC to 200 AD. And then we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we've got thousands of documents here and fragments of documents that were recovered in the 1947 through 56 time period in the area of Qumran. These are still being studied extensively today, and we'll be covering those in some detail later. And then one of the main sources for this period is Josephus, and I mentioned him already. We've got two copies of his books here in the library. We did spend quite a bit of time going over his life and importance because he is such an important source for the period. The only thing I want to say here in summary is I've listed his four major works there: the Jewish Wars, the Antiquities of the Jews, Life, which is an autobiography, and then Against Appian, which is a treatise in defense of the Jews. The biggest source for what we're going to be doing is the Antiquities of the Jews. That's his major historical work. And we'll be referring to that at various points. The importance of Josephus is that he draws on many sources that we don't have copies of now. So he had access to documents that he copied or paraphrased in his writings that we don't have anymore. So that's historically very important. Also, he was there during the Jewish Wars. He actually participated in them as a military leader. So his firsthand account of the Jewish Wars is unique. It's from a firsthand knowledge. He's also the main source of understanding the Jewish sects. We mentioned the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the traditions that are present in the New Testament era. One of the main reasons we know about all of that is through Josephus. He's also a main source of the high priest that carried on through the intertestamental period. I have a section on the priesthood that we're going to talk about in a little while. We'll go through what was happening with the priesthood. But a lot of that comes from Josephus. And then I added this, beyond the recording of facts and events, one of the interesting things about reading Josephus is you get a lot of insight into the culture and the thinking of both Jews and Gentiles. The way I put it is his writings really capture the feel of the period. So that's one benefit of reading the primary sources, is you get like a feel for what's actually happening. I didn't put this in the outline, but we did cover a whole bunch of other historians that I'm just going to skip over here. But there's a ton of Greek and Roman historians that we mentioned in the class before that they're not really writing. Well, some of them are important historians. Actually, a lot of them are important historians. One of them is Herodotus, what is called the father of history. Some of these wrote big histories of Rome and things like that. The reason they're interesting for us is because they sort of incidentally refer to things that were happening in Palestine, more from a political standpoint, but we can get insight into things because they happen to mention in passing something about the Jews as a people or some event that happened in Palestine. And so most of the second sources that you read, like if you read some of the scholars who write about the intertestamental period, they'll bring all that in for you and reference it so you don't have to spend too much time looking for any of that information. But I just mentioned that in passing. There are a few scattered, sort of smaller snippets of sources that come into play here. Okay, any questions about the sources? Matt? Yeah, so the question is, what's the place of the Apocrypha in various traditions today? Just to repeat the question, we are going to cover the Apocrypha later in some detail, and I'll try to address that more thoroughly. And one of the interesting things that has come out of this when I get to the end of this study is a natural progression is to talk about the canon of Scripture, and we can cover it there definitely as well. But just to briefly comment on it here, the question specifically about the Jews, so the Apocrypha is not part of the Jewish canon. Maybe Pastor can correct me here if I go off the rails, but it's not part of the Jewish canon. In fact, some of these books were not even completed until later in the first century AD. The first place it really shows up as a collection is in Jerome's translation of the Vulgate. But even there, Jerome, he didn't view them as having any canonical authority. And I forget the term he uses, but he calls them like the other books. They were translated, but he doesn't place them in the same category as the Old Testament. And then there's a lot of historical machinations on how then that the fact that he translated them, they get into the Roman Catholic sort of theology. I believe, Pastor, even in the Roman Catholic Church, they're qualified as, I don't know again what the term is, but I don't think they have, they're like secondary authority or something like that is a term they use. I don't want to put Pastor on the spot if you haven't. I think you're right. I think it's canonical authority, but there is a little bit of a qualification on it, I believe. I'd have to look into that. Right. So that's something we can get into later. But for other traditions, like I've got a Revised English Bible here that has the Apocrypha in it. I believe it's still generally printed in like the Anglican versions of the Bible. I believe in the Protestant camp, they're viewed as useful books without canonical authority, but still worthy of study. I mean, some of the church fathers talk about the fact that they're worthy of study. I think even Luther and Calvin refer to them that way. So that's our tradition, quoting from the Westminster Confession, chapter 1, which I know you're aware of, Matt. The interesting thing is that there's different versions even of how they implement the Apocrypha in the Bible. A lot of people just put it in its own section. But some of the books of the Apocrypha are intertwined with other canonical books. So some people print those sections in the other book. So there's different variants of even what people think about it. That has a lot to do with what you think about the canon if you mix them in like that. But back to your original question about the Jews, I don't believe that the Jews accept the Apocrypha as any canonical body of literature, but with the qualification that you have to remember that most Jews, just like most, quote, Christians, are liberal. And so if you don't believe really in the canon anyways, what difference does it really make? You start to see this intermixing of, you know, quoting the Apocrypha just as if it's of the same value as the Old Testament canon, because I don't believe in the Old Testament canon either, really. It's just a human writing. So you see this kind of, even though officially it's not part of the Old Testament canon, practically, you know, you see this, it's all human writing. So I think in a lot of Judaism, just like in a lot of liberal Christianity, you see that kind of mixing of human writings.